Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. And with by-elections and Brexit dominating our thoughts this evening, I'm sure you, like me, will be eager to hear the thoughts of our panel this evening. Baroness Angela Smith, Labour's leader in the Lords, the Conservative MP and former Minister Alistair Burt, and the former head of the civil service, now crossbench peer Lord Kerslake. So welcome, all of you. And I can call you Bob Kerslake,
can't I? You
can
indeed,
oh,
yes.
Good. Good. Well, you worked closely with David Cameron's government, didn't you, from 2012 to 2014 as head of the civil service. Now you're a crossbench peer. From that perch, does that mean you have to stay unaligned or apolitical?
You're not a member of a political party, and I'm not, nor of a party group within the House of Lords. Obviously, those who are follow the party whip. I don't. I form my views on individual issues, which doesn't mean to say that I won't be challenging and controversial on occasions, as I was on the Housing and Planning Bill last year.
Oh, so you had a few moments, did you, there, where you were challenging the government?
I'd say more than a few, I suspect. I can remember one line vividly, which was in The Sun, I think, where Brandon Lewis said, not only is Lord Kerslake unelected, but he owns his own house and he wants to stop you owning one as well.
Ah, OK.
So that was saying it, wasn't it?
More from you later. Alistair Burt, you represented Bury and Greater Manchester until 1997. Then you came back for North East Bedfordshire in 2001. You've been a Foreign Office and a Health Minister. You're a member of the Exiting the EU Select Committee. You were and presumably are a big Remainer.
Yep.
Or are you reconciled to Brexit now?
Well, I'm reconciled to the extent that I accept that the country's made a decision. And I'm quite keen on getting on with the job, but I'm doing so from a pro-European, pro-EU position, and this is very unusual. Up until now, people who've spoken about the UK being outside the EU have always done so from a standpoint of wanting to leave and various degrees of, you know, quite aggressive dislike of the EU. Now we've got a situation where those of us who support the EU, want to see it prosper and succeed, now have to work through a relationship with the EU, with the UK on the outside, because we cannot go on for another 50 years deciding whether or not the UK should be in or out of the EU. It's debilitating our politics.
Is the decision irrevocable, do you think? Because some of your colleagues think that there's still a hope of changing it.
Not in the short term, but in the long term, in a democracy, anything is possible if the public want it and Parliament can move very swiftly on this. But I think to plan for that would genuinely be wrong. Accordingly, let's plan to make this a success, and that's what I want to see the government do. But I want to see it done from a pro-EU point of view, not a view that hates the EU, as some of my colleagues, I think, barely contain themselves from saying.
We'll be talking about the latest Brexit moves in the Lords a little later, but Angela Smith, Baroness Smith of Basildon, as Labour's leader in the House of Lords, you are a member of the party's top team, aren't you? Part of the leadership. Given the loss of the Copeland by-election after, 80 years, some of your colleagues have called it a catastrophic low. How would you characterise the mood in Labour's ranks?
Oh, I think people are desperately upset at losing Copeland. We'd recognised it was possible as the campaign went on, but no one can take any comfort from such a devastating result. And obviously it's great that we won the other seat in Stoke, which is interesting, isn't it? Because everyone was saying how the intervention of Tony Blair on Brexit would made sure we wouldn't win Stoke. We held Stoke. Brexit wasn't the issue that lost us the votes in that constituency, but we lost Copeland, which I don't think has been anything other than Labour in living memory.
Is Jeremy Corbyn's departure part of the solution to Labour's woes, do you think?
I don't think we're going to see Jeremy going anywhere soon. He got elected with a huge mandate only last year, and I think he's made clear he intends to stay on. But I think people will be expecting to hear from him what exactly he can do to bring people together and to ensure we don't have such a terrible result in a by-election again. Now, it is unprecedented for an opposition party at this stage in a parliament to lose a seat like that. And it really hurts us when we lose, especially with such a great candidate.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn has been speaking today. He attended the Scottish Labour conference earlier on. Let's hear what he had to say to that conference.
I'm carrying on as leader because I'm determined that we will deliver social justice in this country. We will end the misery of people sleeping on our streets and children growing up in disgusting and disgraceful poverty and growing levels of inequality promoted by a Tory government that frankly doesn't...
And you'll definitely be leader in 2020.
I've given you a very, very clear answer, yes.
Clear answer. And there's been heartfelt support from the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, who appeared with John Pienaar on Five Live this morning.
One of the issues that people are not voting for us is because they see a divided party. In the last 20 months, half of them have been in leadership elections where we look divided. It isn't about a leadership election. It is about us coming together, listening to people, developing the policies, but also making sure those policies are communicated in words that people fully appreciate. Now, that isn't just down to the leadership, that's down to every member of the party, but it's also down to every wing of the party. That's why I'm just saying I understand Copeland. It's hit me very personally very hard. And it's hit personally Jeremy very hard. But let's turn it into an opportunity now.
How do you do that, Angela?
I don't know. I think that's what Jeremy's got to outline. And, I think he's absolutely clear. He says we're determined to deliver social justice. But I think people want to hear from him, how is that going to be done? Because until people really believe we are a credible opposition and a government in waiting, they're not listening to us. And that's, I think, the great worry. And if this becomes a spiral and we get more bad results, then I think the Labour Party will be quite despairing. Now, if you look at the talent we've got in our parliamentary party amongst our MPs, there's some fantastic people there that should be out, shouting from the rooftops what Labour can do. So I think right about the party uniting, but we need to have a common purpose. And I think it's up to the leader to illustrate that, to show that and take the lead in promoting that.
And Bob Kerslake, from your time working with the government and now watching from the Lords, how important is it to have a functioning opposition?
I think it's crucially important. I'm not a member of a political party, as I said, but I am a Democrat, and I believe that democracies work best when you have strong, challenging oppositions, and we're not at that point at the moment, it has to be said. Of course, Angela provides terrific leadership in the Lords, that goes without saying, but across the piece, governments that are in the position they're in now can often turn out to be governments that don't listen because they don't need to. And you see it in local government as well as central government.
And you're president of the Local Government Association, aren't
you? Yes, and often those councils that are overwhelmingly one party or another are the ones that you can see issues arise. And of course, what often happens is you see oppositions forming within the leading party rather than the main opposition outside the party. So I don't think it's good for democracy to be where we are at the moment.
You did see Jeremy Corbyn challenging Theresa May on that question of council tax rises. Surrey County Council, he said they'd been offered a sweetheart deal to help pay for social care. I mean, he was effective in many people's eyes there in pinning down the Prime Minister.
He had a good day on that day, I think, if you stood back from it and looked at it objectively. The challenge, of course, is how do you have a series of good days where you make arguments that get government to change their minds? And it is in this particular period, I think, with Brexit, with severe issues in relation to care and health, that you need governments to reflect on the issues and think again.
I think it's interesting when Jeremy has a good day at Prime Minister's questions, he betters Theresa May at dispatch box. Behind him, the Parliamentary Labour Party are right there with him. They want him to be like that all the time. So when they talk about unity, there they show real unity. They want Jeremy to do well, and they're crying out for that. And I think, particularly
your view is
on that
one, it doesn't happen enough.
It doesn't happen all the time. And I think when it does, he sees the support that's there for him. People want him to do well. People want him to challenge the government, and they want him to show such leadership.
Alistair, 1997, for your colleagues, that was a very low point for the Conservatives. Is there a way, can you offer some words of comfort to Labour who think that they may be facing decades in the wilderness?
Well, my personal experience of having been elected in 1983, 34 years ago, I've seen the party in a very powerful position and lose it, and I've seen the party in a very weak position and regain it. So the comfort is that the wheel can turn. But Bob is right, democracy needs an opposition, but opposition has to be earned. It can't be there just because, oh, well, there must be opposition. It's got to be earned, and at the moment it's not being. So what you will find is Theresa May and our government, we've got a memory. We know what it's like to be in a position and lose it. So she is going to listen. she is going to want to make sure she keeps the party united, because we've seen the dangers of the past. And I think the fact that we've had a memory, and also when I was elected in 83, we had the same number of MPs in the northwest of England as Labour did. So we've got a residue of support up there, and we will work at it very hard.
What about the temptation to have a general election sooner rather than later?
I don't think it even crosses her mind, and the reason for that is she wants to get on with the job. If we were seen to go for a general election for opportunistic purposes, without there being any need, if she's reversed a couple of times in the Commons, that makes things very difficult. But I don't think she wants to. I think she wants to get on with the job, and I think that's what the public have picked up.
Let me bring in here Tom Newton-Dunn, the political editor of The Sun. I mean, you talk to people all the time. You talk to Labour MPs and Conservatives as well. What's your reading of Labour's position now?
I think it really is bad. There's no two ways of looking at this. And it really isn't just about Jeremy Corbyn. I think it's quite obvious he will never win a general election in charge of the Labour Party, for Labour or anyone else. But that also, just to point at the finger at Jeremy alone, would be to mask over an entire array of policies of which there is absolutely no agreement whatsoever across the party. Some mammoth ones, for example, Brexit. We saw the mess, the division in the party during the Article 50 vote a couple of weeks ago in the Commons. Immigration. What's the party's immigration policy? No agreement at all. Borrowing, the economy. So I think the first step for Labour's recovery, if Alistair predicts at some stage this may happen, will be to lose Jeremy Corbyn as leader. And then there's the civil war that will play out over what shape of party they're going to be. A centrist party again, or a far-left party. And I think this begins possibly with another set of election results coming in May, the local elections, which, let's face it, it's unlikely Jeremy Corbyn's going to be doing particularly well on as well. And with the Unite leadership settled, then Labour has a potential chance with the new leader of Unite, either Gerald Coyne or currently Liam McCluskey, then tapping Jeremy Corbyn on the shoulder to say, now I'm afraid the time really is up, we need someone else.
Well, it was interesting. I've been talking to Harriet Harman. We're actually, it's an interview that we're going to be broadcasting most of next week. She's reflecting on her long political career after her memoirs. She has been instinctively loyal to the Labour Party and loyal to the leadership. But just have a listen to this extract when she's reflecting on Labour's 1983 general election defeat, a historic low point for the party, and what she calls the painful echoes of the situation today.
Some people in the party thought that if people got fed up enough with the Tories, they would automatically turn to Labour. And what I was saying is, however fed up people get with the Tories, they won't turn to Labour unless they feel that not only we can identify their problems, but that we are the solution to their problems. The other thing is that some people felt that if we had a mass membership and lots of demonstrations, that somehow this would mean we were on our way to getting into power. And I remember Neil Kinnock saying, never mistake the enthusiasm of the minority for the support of the majority. You have to be listening to people's concerns and then start winning the argument. And we've got a lot of groundwork to do.
So you see the parallels between what you wrote then and the position Labour's in today?
Painful echoes. And that's what is so concerning. We didn't get into government until 1997. We lost four general elections before we got into government. Now we've lost two already. And I hope we won't have to lose two more before we get into government.
Do you think it's likely that it might take that long?
Well, I think it depends on what we do. If we recognise the problem is not the public, but us, and that it's not the public that's got to change, but we've got to change, then I think that we can start building again.
How much of Labour's success depends on its leader or the team around the leader?
Well, I think the role of the leader is enormously important, because what the leader is at the top of a massive team. And really, it's the role of the leader to bring that whole team together and face outwards to people in the country. And I think the problem is, if you face inwards, either congratulating yourself on how many members you've got or thinking that you've got a huge mandate after your election, a mandate from the members. Well, a mandate from the members is important, but the real job of a leader of the opposition is to get the mandate from the people in a general election to be a Labour Prime Minister.
Do you think Jeremy Corbyn can do that?
His job, as the job of every leader of the opposition, is to win public support to lead that great Labour team into government, and certainly to bring the party together. Because the thing about being leader is the buck stops with you. You can't be blaming anybody. You can't be saying the members have got it wrong. You can't be saying the public have got it wrong. You can't be saying MPs have got it wrong. The buck stops with you, and you have to take responsibility for making it right, not getting it wrong and then blaming other people, whether it's the media or anybody else. It's very hard being leader of the opposition, very hard indeed. But that's the job that's got to be done in order for this country not to be a one-party state in the hands of the Tories.
So, Angela and Tom, I mean, briefly, do you think there is a way of amending this disconnect, as it seems, between Jeremy Corbyn and Labour's core voters?
Yes, I think there is and there has to be. And I take sort of some disagreement with Tom over what he was saying about how divided the Labour Party is. Actually, on Brexit, the Labour Party isn't divided on values, merely on the tactics, and that's what's about your voting. And as we move to the next stage, as we've gone past Article 50 and we're looking at the detail of the new legislation the government's going to be bringing in, I think you'll see a very united Labour Party trying to hold on to a lot of those values and those policies that came from Europe. But I think, no, Harriet's right, there is a huge responsibility on a leader to pull that together. And that's what I think people are going to be looking for from Jeremy in the weeks and months to come.
Tom Newton.
Angela, one quarter of all your MPs refuse to vote for Article 50. That means they don't want Brexit to happen. 63% of all your voters in the country also don't want Brexit to happen. That's a seismic split.
No, it is a seismic split on
tactics.
Article 50. No, it is about tactics. It was about whether or not to vote for and have a three-line whip to invoke Article 50. I actually think Jeremy called it right on that. As much as I'm a Remainer and do not like the fact that we're leaving the EU, I don't think there's any choice. But I understand those MPs who are in constituencies where the majority of their constituents voted Remain, they feel that voice has to be heard as well. I wouldn't criticise them for doing so.
Well, Tom, the Article 50 Brexit bill, withdrawal from the EU bill, starts to go through its detailed progress in the Lords, doesn't it, this week? And talk of several amendments being tabled. Give us a sort of succinct impression of what we can expect.
Well, here we go.
As only you can.
Here we go again. We've had this in the Commons, now we're having it again in the Lords. Week two, actually, in the Lords, and there'll be one further day next week as well. This week, two interesting things will probably happen. The Lords debate on Monday and Wednesday. There's going to be an interesting debate about an amendment about Northern Ireland tomorrow, which is going to be all about trying to get the government to pay attention to the fact that the Good Friday Agreement could potentially collapse under Brexit, because the Good Friday Agreement was all based on membership of the EU and the border between the North and South being open. We probably won't see a vote there. We will see a vote, I think, and certainly Andrew would be able to help us on this, on Wednesday, when the Lords debate reciprocal rights for EU citizens living here and also Brits living in Europe. And there's a big move afoot in the Lords to force Theresa May to grant this here and now. It was in the House of Commons as well, and I can't quite remember whether Alistair voted for it, but certainly he didn't.
No,
but
he didn't.
Several of his colleagues
did. He shook his head.
And several more abstained. So the Lords will certainly send the Article 50 bill back to the Commons amended. And then Alistair and his pro-Remain pals will have another chance, potentially, to vote through that amendment.
So, Alistair, the Prime Minister says, and we heard Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, today saying, it will be dealt with, this question of EU nationals' rights. Are you absolutely assured that it will be the priority that government ministers are telling us it will be, and it will be dealt with quickly?
Yes.
Without being on the face of the bill?
No, I am absolutely convinced of that. I mean, for two reasons. Firstly, Amber Rudd also makes the point that in order for EU citizens' rights to be changed, there has to be an act of Parliament to do it, because those rights will automatically be part of what's been termed as the Great Repeal Bill. In order to change those rights, Parliament has got to decide to change them. So we actively have to do something against EU citizens' rights. We're just not going to do it, and the government doesn't even want to contemplate that. So the government is very determined to get this sorted amongst other member states, as we know. Hasn't been possible to do so before the negotiations started. But we all know that it must be done, and it will be done.
Bob
Kersley. I'm assured.
Well, I'm afraid either whether you're a Remainer or a Leaver, I think the government's position is both inhumane and self-defeating. We need the EU nationals to say in this country, you know, in effect, just look at the house building. 70% of the house builders in London come from Eastern European countries. We cannot see these people go. And yet in the meantime...
But if the guarantees are there, it just won't be on the face of the bill. Is that not enough for you?
Well, until the guarantees are there, until government...
But they are.
Aren't, I'm afraid, because they're being used as a bargaining chip in a way that's quite inappropriate.
Well, it is true. It's exactly what the Prime Minister said. It is what she said, because what she said was she wanted not to guarantee the rights of EU nationals at this stage, because she wanted to use that in discussions with the other EU countries to ensure we could guarantee the rights of UK citizens living in the EU. Now, I think it's a period of uncertainty that is unacceptable. You have our citizens, UK citizens living in Europe, who don't know what's going to happen to them. And you just have to look at our emails and our postbags to know how concerned they are. And EU citizens living here, and businesses and care homes, etc., saying how worried they are. It's a very easy thing to do. And wouldn't it really set off negotiations in a good tone if this was to be said very early on, yes, we protect the right of EU nationals and we want the right of UK nationals to be there? It's a very easy thing to do.
One sentence from Alistair and then back to Tom.
I'm not sure there's very much more the Prime Minister can do than what she has already done. She's already taken this to other EU leaders to say it should be a priority. She was rebuffed and told it had to wait until the start of negotiations. It's in all our interests, both the UK and the EU, to guarantee those rights, and I'm absolutely certain they will be.
Tom, the other issue under discussion and amendment is this question of a meaningful vote. Lord Heseltine, Tarzan himself, has said that he is going to vote for the amendment, giving Parliament a veto, effectively, over the outcome of the negotiations. You know, it's this call for a meaningful vote, which is, what, enshrining Parliament's right to tell Theresa May to go back and negotiate further if they're not happy with the deal.
Well, this is the amendment that's going to be absolutely fascinating. And this we won't see a vote on it this week, I don't think. That will be for next week. Conveniently for political journalists, the evening before the budget. So the week after next is going to be a true shocker for us. But this is when I think Theresa May could be in quite serious trouble, not just in the Lords, and they almost certainly will win this amendment, to give Parliament not just a vote, but a meaningful say, which means a veto on whatever Theresa May comes back. That's not just a deal or no deal. That's no deal, in which case you can go back to Brussels and keep on doing this, please, Mrs. May. So it's a really, really big deal. And there's an extra complication in this as well, which is a speech made by Lord Hope, the former Deputy Supreme Court President, at the start of the Article 50 bill next week. And both Bob and Andrew are nodding their heads vigorously. It sounds like they were listening to that, where he said, I'm not going to vote for Parliament to get a veto on this because I think the government should be allowed to do what it does, pleasing Mrs. May. But in my view as a lawyer and as a former Supreme Court justice, I don't think what she has done in terms of just offering Parliament a vote is going to be enough to satisfy the Supreme Court verdict at the end of this whole process in 2 years' time. I think Parliament's going to have to pass a whole new act, yet another Article 50 exit bill, right down the other end of the system, we might see some interesting movement from Theresa May.
But he added, and if this bill isn't amended, we'd need more legislation. So an amendment to this bill would be quite helpful to the Prime Minister in that regard. She has promised to do it, and I don't understand, if you promise to do something, why you don't want to put that promise in legislation.
Alistair Burr?
I'd simply make the point that in the run-up to the discussions in Parliament, both in Lords and Commons, the government has proved that it is capable of listening and wants to listen. Concessions, well, not concessions, but the move on the white paper, the strategy setting out where we were going in terms of negotiations, the vote at the end of the process itself. These all came about not through being defeated on amendments, but by the Prime Minister listening to colleagues, listening to the opposition, and trying to work by way not of being reversed, but by saying, if this is good sense, we will try and do it in these extraordinary circumstances that Brexit has landed on us all.
Well, Theresa May has said, hasn't she, Tom, that no deal is better than a bad deal. But there is now this hope with this amendment that there could be a chance of saying to her, look, go back in a vote in about 18 months' time, maybe go back and try to get a better deal. Now, I asked the Leader of the House of Commons, David Lidington, about that when I spoke to him for an interview on Thursday. This is what he told me.
We'll listen with respect, as always, to the Lords when they debate the bill. What I don't think we can do is say that if X or Y hypothetical event takes place, those successes, though the Prime Minister could have to go back. I mean, that's an invitation to the people with whom we are negotiating to adapt their tactics to try and put us at a disadvantage. We need to leave the Prime Minister and her team with the freedom to negotiate, get the best deal possible, and then, yes, to report back.
And if the government really means it about things like a meaningful final vote or reassurances about EU nationals, why not write those reassurances onto the face of the bill? Why not put it into
Because you don't. You, it is not always the best tactic to put something into the inflexible form of legislation. I really don't think that anything of greater substance would be achieved than that by writing it into the bill, and there's a risk that it just introduces that extra element of inflexibility. The relationship between Parliament and government is that there are certain things that governments do on behalf of the country, and they are accountable to Parliament then for those decisions and those the approach they've taken in negotiations. But, you know, I've been in the House of Commons long enough to know that Parliament finds ways in which to hold ministers to account. We're not afraid of that as ministers, but we need to have, as a government, the freedom to go and negotiate with 27 other governments the best deal we can for the UK.
There are reports that cabinet ministers are in secret talks to give fresh reassurances to peers and MPs that there will be a meaningful vote. Are you involved in secret talks?
Secret talks usually means a meeting that the journalist in question hasn't been invited to. You know,
So you've been at those meetings, have you?
Talks go on the whole time. I mean, the job of myself is to be talking to and equally importantly listening to our colleagues in both houses the whole time. Amendments have been tabled in the Lords. They'll be debated. If they're pressed to a vote, there'll be a division. We'll see what the Lords do. If the Lords were to pass any amendments, then they return to the House of Commons, and the House of Commons will have to consider them at that point.
There we are, David Lidington, vigorously banging the table during that interview. Tom, it was your story about the secret meetings. Now, he said you wrote it just because you weren't invited. But are you getting any sense of, talks under the surface? Maybe Angela will be able to help us as well with this.
Well, I hope she would. It's true, I wasn't invited, certainly. But generally, as a journalist, you don't really get invited to ministers' meetings. We have to write about them instead. Very interestingly, David Lidington there didn't deny anything that we wrote about this. In fact, he left the door wide open even to potentially accepting some of these amendments if they're passed. Alistair is nodding vigorously in support of such a suggestion. So I think the government will move a mile to try and get a decent agreement out of the Lords and some Remainers on their own side in the Commons as well, for the really, really simple reason that David Lidington spelled out crystal clear in the middle of his answer to you there, which is Parliament is sovereign. At the end of the day, you can have the greatest negotiation in the world, come back to Parliament, present it. If you cannot get MPs and peers to agree that, you might as well start all over again. So Theresa May will never, ever, when it comes to the bottom line, be able to go round Parliament.
Andrew Smith, though, if the government chucks out your amendments, you have no more ammunition, do you? Because you have, in several interviews, absolutely guaranteed that you will not disrupt Theresa May's plans to trigger Article 50 by the end of March. So aren't you just firing blanks?
Absolutely not. And I think it would be totally inappropriate for an unelected House of Lords to veto a decision taken, well, firstly, the recommendation of the referendum and then voted on by the House of Commons. But I think we're making a very strong case on these. I say there's a number of issues. We've heard about Northern Ireland, but particularly the vote petition of the EU nationals and our UK nationals, and also on that final vote. And I really don't accept that because the Prime Minister said it's enough. We all remember when Alf Dubs spoke to then Theresa May when she was Home Secretary on the child refugees, took a number out of his amendment to get it through because the government gave him guarantees, and look what has happened there. I think that proves you need to have these kinds of promises and commitments. And Alistair's quite right. The government didn't accept amendments in the House of Commons, but they did make changes and promises, but they need to be on the face of the bill.
Brief word, Bob Curtis.
Yes, in the end, the Commons will hold sway, and that's as it should be, because they're the elected chamber. But if I was a betting man, I think we will see a commitment to a vote when we come to the agreement. I think it's untenable not to say that eventually.
Tom, other things happening this week. We've got the Northern Ireland elections, of course, on Thursday. But there seems to be a brewing row over disability. There's signs of another battle brewing over benefits claims that the Conservative government's looking to cut nearly £4 billion by scaling back entitlement to personal independence payments. What's that all about?
That's correct. I think we'll see a fair bit of shouting this week, in certainly in the Commons, while the Lords are busy discussing Article 50. Possibly even some sort of vote Labour and Lib Dems might try and combine to bring in the Commons on this. And this is the government, in the last few days, passing a very quick bit of legislation, something called a statutory instrument, to try and reverse a court decision made a few months ago to effectively increase the size of the PIP bill, the personal independence payment bill, which is the disability benefit, by some £3.7 billion, by enlarging the amount of people who can get it. And this is for people who have got perhaps mental anxieties, agoraphobic, stress-related anxieties that stops them from going out. They, the courts say, should be entitled to PIP. The government have passed new laws to now stop that, and it's creating merry hell. Of course, this is all about the budget, which is coming up in the week after next, where, quite frankly, Philip Hammond simply doesn't have 3.7 billion quid to pull from the back of the sofa. Quite the opposite, with the deficit now mounting up ever higher all over again.
And a gentleman called George Freeman has got into a little bit of trouble over this today.
He made a very vigorous defence of the government's position on the penal... He's a very interesting and thoughtful Tory MP, also head of the Prime Minister's policy unit. So not a member of the government, very close to the Prime Minister, certainly speaks perhaps for her, made a very vigorous defence of this, in which he said we can't just give out money to people sitting at home popping pills, which was a slightly unfortunate use of phrase. You get the point he's trying to make. It offended quite a few people. I imagine he'll be getting a rap over the knuckles for that.
And Alistair Burt, you in a past life have been the minister in charge of disability issues. What do you make of the way that George Freeman has handled this?
Well, responsible for both disability and then mental health until last summer. As Tom's indicated, George Freeman is the last person in the world that I would consider capable of a deliberately insensitive remark. It's a difficult judgment for the government. The government wants to make sure that people who, the severity of their condition, whether it's physical or mental, that would qualify for PIP should get it. Already the bill for PIPs is due to go up from £16.5 billion this year to £19 billion by 2021. So it's a significant commitment from the government anyway. But we must be absolutely sure, and the government must be clear, that if it brings policy back to where it was intended to be, which is the purpose of the legislation, that it still covers situations where people, no matter what the origin of their condition may be, and mental health matters as much to us as physical health, we've got to be absolutely sure it's related to the severity of the condition. And that's the most important thing.
All right. So you understand this issue from handling it before. However, we now have a call from Labour for an apology from George Freeman, and there is a head of steam now building up over this issue and real anger building about what the government's planning. What about George Freeman's comments?
Well, as I say, I know George quite well. George is not the sort of person to make a deliberately insensitive remark, and he's already said on his own behalf, he said, look, I've suffered from these things myself, so he said, I'm not going to be spoken to by other people about this. This is a matter for George. But I do know that the policy intention, that the original policy, we believe, was changed by the courts. Now, we've got to get back to what the policy originally was, but the government's got to make it very clear that physical and mental health has the same priority for us, and I suspect that's what ministers will be pressed to make clear in the coming days.
Well, indeed. Yes, Labour intends to force this issue to a Commons vote, I understand. Now, when George Osborne last year tried to scale back the PIP
idea,
it led to the resignation of Ian Duncan-Smith as Welfare Secretary, didn't it? And then was
the
changed.
Government
Do
changed
you suspect, briefly, a climb down in the budget then?
Genuinely, I don't know. I don't know, because I don't know to what extent the changes brought about in the legislation will affect the basic need for PIP payments. I already know, and many of us know from constituency cases, it's quite difficult sometimes for constituents with mental health issues to persuade the people who are making the adjudications. And that's where part of the problem lies, to make the adjudications fair. But this is the same government where Damien Green said the other week, we're changing the rules to make sure that those who suffer from chronic illnesses will not have to be retested. Right. So I think the overall sense of the government being determined to help people in the most difficult circumstances is still proved.
Angela Smith.
I just really worry about this. When we hear so often from the government that mental and physical health must be treated equally within the National Health Service and the benefit system, it does appear from this that mental health is getting less regard than physical health. Mm. If your condition is such that you're unable to get out on your own or go somewhere or do something because of mental health, that can't be any different if you can't do it because of a physical health issue. Mm. So if we have, we either have parity in both, or we put our hands up and say this government has decided there isn't parity between the two and people with mental health conditions are treated less seriously, less favourably than those with physical health conditions.
Tom Newton Dunn is leaving us now to go off and have a look at the front pages. He'll be back just before the end of the programme. But just a quick reminder that there is a programme on BBC Two tomorrow night at 9 o'clock called Meet the Lords. Here's a little flavour of it.
It is the best daycare centre for the elderly in London. Families can drop in him or her as early and then make sure that the staff will look after them very well. There'll be nice meals subsidised by the taxpayer and they can have a snooze in the chamber in the afternoon or in the library.
I look at what the Lords does and what the Commons does and the comparative legislative chaos that is being sent from the Commons to the Lords. And I genuinely think, thank God, the Lords are there to do the serious work without just being inundated with the political point scoring.
We're a bit like a composting machine. Whatever comes out the other end is always more fragrant and more fertile than what went in. So you see, we are really, in the House of Lords, we're really just parliamentary worms.
So, Bob Kerslake, a great day centre, final gentleman's club. Some of you do a lot of work, most of you do nothing.
Yes, I hope he was joking when he said that. But look, what I've seen, observed, as somebody who's been in the Lords now for 2 years, some very, very hard-working peers who are experts in their field and push hard to debate and change legislation and do things that make a real impact on people's lives. So I really hope people don't form their judgment on those one or two comments and watch the whole free programmes, in fact, and see what we do.
Angela Smith, Theresa May turned up to watch you in action in the Lords, didn't she?
Did.
Some papers said she was employing her death stare on you.
I didn't feel that at all. I was really pleased she was there. Absolutely. And it showed enormous credit to her that she does turn up to the debate in the House of Commons. But I've spent 13 years in the Commons. I was 6 years so far in the House of Lords. I feel like I've never worked so hard in my life. And it's quite interesting. On one hand, there's you got people like Paul Tyler, a Liberal Democrat, making that, I think, pretty much the tongue-in-cheek...
Point about the day centre.
Yeah, that tongue-in-cheek comment. Yeah. But you've also got the whole world looking at what we're doing on Brexit. Now, anyone thinks we're not working hard, we're sitting regularly at the moment till midnight to have these debates and look at the issues.
Right.
Let's get it in balance.
Well, look, sitting next to Theresa May when she went to watch the Lords in action was David Lidington. We heard from him earlier. He's the leader of the Commons, the minister charged with steering government business through. We've heard about some of the problems storing up for the government, you know, business rates, disability cuts, the costs of social care and complaints about a new funding formula for schools in England. When I spoke to David Lidington last Thursday, I asked him how hampered he was by the government's small majority.
The size of the majority does make a difference, as does the fact that we're the first Conservative government in modern times to have no majority in the House of Lords. So the process of handling legislation is more challenging than it was under previous governments, I think much of the last 20 years. But I think that there are a number of ways in which you address this. I mean, the first is quite simply to try to be alert to currents of opinion within Parliament and to have your antennae out the whole time as to where people, not just in the governing parties, but in the opposition parties too, might have problems. But I think more fundamentally, it's about improving the quality and preparation of legislation. You need to stress test legislation before you bring it before Parliament. If we're going to have a battle in Parliament, I want the battles to be ones that we have deliberately chosen to fight because we think they're the right political fights, not something we stumbled into by accident because we haven't thought through the consequences and the susceptibility of a bill to amendment.
Talking about the numbers then, most recently I've been talking to a number of Conservative MPs concerned about moves to overhaul school funding in England. They're threatening to vote against the new system unless the government makes last-minute changes to the plans. We've heard about backbenchers really unhappy about changes to business rates. Are you answering their concerns?
Take your example of school funding formula. We've published possible ways in which a new formula might operate. We've invited responses on that. There's recent decision.
And you're aware
decision.
Of the unhappiness among backbenchers.
Yeah, there's recent, but this is a consultation that is still live. It was the most recent version of this, for the first time, gave illustrative figures of how this might work out in practice and how it might affect particular local authorities. And clearly people are going to want to examine those, think how that applies to their own constituencies, but this is still an ongoing process. It's not yet finished. And you know, any government that's sensible listens carefully to parliamentary opinion.
The pressure over something like business rates, though, and the confusion that there was after Prime Minister's questions, the Chancellor says he's open to listening. So presumably, given the numbers and the pressure from your backbenchers, do you expect him to use his budget to mitigate
I'm not going to speculate on what the Chancellor's going to put in the budget, but he said what he did say. The Prime Minister said at the Prime Minister's questions this week that the Chancellor and the Local Government Secretary were working closely together, in particular to see whether there was anything more that could be done to help those businesses that look likely to experience a very sharp upward movement in business rates. But, you know, in any talk about government money, this all has to come out of taxpayers' pockets at the end of the day, and, you know, no Chancellor has a sort of crock of gold sitting at the foot of his bed.
Tony Blair, in his recent speech, said that the government has bandwidth for only one thing, which is Brexit. He described the government as a monopurpose political entity.
I think Mr. Blair is simply wrong. And not only do I think he's wrong, but the Prime Minister has said again and again in public and in cabinet meetings, I do not want this government to be defined entirely by Brexit. We have to get that right. We have to do the best job we can to get the right deal.
Did you enjoy your trip to the House of Lords to see the start of the debate? There were pictures of you alongside the Prime Minister. You were described in one paper as her henchman.
Oh, yeah, that was a first.
They were.
I mean, that was...
How did you greet that description?
That wasn't one I briefed out. It was the first time for many years that a serving Prime Minister had attended a House of Lords debate in that way. But I thought it was a really good thing that she did.
The idea that there was a slight air of menace sitting there in the House of Lords, you know, there's always the Parliament Act that you could enact to get your legislation through, or pack the upper house with more peers and get rid of the ones that are there.
I think that there are one or two of your colleagues in the press gallery who are, you know, desperate to sort of read some Hitchcockian angle to this into the record. I mean, it's not how it is.
Just going back to how the Commons operates, and obviously with John Bercow, there has been a lot more inclusion of the public, far greater outreach. He's not everyone's cup of tea, as we've seen recently with some calls for him to step down. But he has introduced more things like urgent questions, the use of them far more rigorously. Do you think he's been a good speaker, John Bercow?
Look, John is my constituency neighbour. I've always had a decent working relationship with him. I think there are some things I think he's really done well. The use of the urgent questions, I think, has strengthened Parliament. There are decisions. I mean, you know, I, like the rest of the government, you know, clearly took a different view about President Trump's state visit than the Speaker did.
William Hague, Andrew Lansley, Sir George Young, Jack Straw, Geoffrey Howe. The job of Leader of the Commons seems to come at the end of a long parliamentary career. Is that how you see it, or do you think it can be the stepping stone to something else?
I think the most truthful answer to that, Carol, is that is not a decision for me. I don't lie awake at night worrying about that.
But you did get the chance, I don't know whether you'd call it an opportunity or a torture, to stand in at Prime Minister's questions, didn't you?
It was the single most terrifying thing I have done in politics in 25 years in the House of Commons. All your colleagues and all the opposition colleagues are looking at you. How's he going to get on? You know, Andrew Neil has paused Daily Politics on the BBC One, is sort of going to watch and then comment on how you perform. And it is so gladiatorial. I mean, this is the nearest thing to entering a boxing ring I'm ever likely to do in my lifetime. And I sort of got to the end of it And two thoughts went through my head simultaneously. One, well, not many people have done that. Two, she has to do it every Wednesday. It's not something to do if you've got a problem with nerves. I slept the night before, and the night after I'd done it, on the Wednesday night, the adrenaline was pumping so hard, I barely slept at all.
Well, there we are, David Liddington, the leader of the Commons, taking PMQs. Now, Tom is back with the front pages. What have we got, Tom?
The Guardian is splashing on yet another data loss by the NHS. 500,000 documents going missing between 2011 and 2016. The biggest single loss in the NHS is 69-year history, the Guardian says. The Mirror splashing on the betrayal of our children, which is a report out tomorrow saying a giant 6.5% funding cut is on its way by 2020 to the education budget, simply because of the ring fencing is no longer going to be sustainable for the school's budget.
Yeah, we mentioned school funding in that interview there with David Liddington.
The FT has a story about US banks as a splash, but a fascinating little picture story that caught my eye, saying that the Tory party want to buy back Europe House, which is, of course, the famous Tory party headquarters of a years gone by in Smith Square, the one where Margaret Thatcher famously leant out the window, as did John Major. And, of course, the party got a little bit poorer and had to sell it to the EU. Mm. The ironies being of that one are multifold, yeah. Of course. But the Daily Telegraph have a story which Downing Street are already busily telling everyone is mere speculation, which will become a very big deal quite soon, I speculate, which is that the cut-off date where people will, EU citizens living here, 3.2 million EU citizens currently living here, will no longer are allowed to be able to live here. As we know, free movement is going to end under Brexit. Theresa May will announce, as she triggers Article 50, that cut-off date will be the one and the same day. So once Article 50 is triggered and Brexit negotiations begin, no EU citizens will have rights to stay here forever much longer. Now, I am told Number 10 also believe this is going to be part of the two-year-long debate. There may not be any firm announcements by Theresa May, but certainly this date has become hugely important because it means potentially 200,000 more Romanian and Bulgarians will come here if the 74,000 a year statistic from the ONS was right this week. And that may or may not be something which the good people of Britain want.
Briefly, Alistair Burt, do you think an Act of Parliament would be needed to change these rights?
I think that for those people who will already be here at the cut-off date, it is a further guarantee of their rights. And, of course, things will be different once Article 50 is triggered. But I think we also need to be very conscious of this. The Select Committee hasn't met a single employer all around the country who wants to see their workers from the EU go home. They're needed for jobs. We'll continue to need them. Exactly. And I think we're going to have to change the rhetoric about this very markedly because businesses need them not only to sustain themselves, but to grow.
And comes back to our point that it needs
to
be settled
much more carefully about how
quickly
we handle all this.
Tom, back to you on the papers.
The Times also have a very good Brexit story. I'm afraid there's going to be a lot of Brexit stories around for the next 2 to 3 years.
Ten years.
Please not. The Times say that someone else is going to be making an announcement around the same time Theresa May triggers Article 50, and that will be one Nicola Sturgeon, Scotland's First Minister, who will choose the very same day to announce that she wants, guess what, to hold another independence referendum. Mm. Simply because Theresa May obviously has created a Brexit that Nicola Sturgeon believes is simply untenable for the people of Scotland, no single market, potentially no customs union. So guess what? We're going to have another referendum.
In our final seconds then, Bob. Angela?
Is anyone looking forward to another referendum? I very much doubt it.
Indeed. But what's extraordinary for me is some of the people who are most passionate about leaving the European Union are also the same people who are most passionate about retaining the United Kingdom. And one is being put at risk by the other.
Yeah. David Cameron's legacy is not going to be a good one.
In terms of?
Well, it can lead into the UK coming out of the EU and the breakup of the Union. And I don't think that's a great legacy to have.
Indeed.
So forcing a great deal of thought about what the UK's relationship with an EU is going to be. A successful EU needs a successful United Kingdom and a good relationship and an end to the hostility that's characterised the last 40 years.
Plenty of work for you and your Brexit Select Committee, Alistair Burt. We have to leave it there now, so I shall say goodbye to all my guests, Angela Smith, Angela Burt, Bob Kerslake, Tom Newton-Dunn. Thanks all. I'll be back same time next week. For now, from all of us on the programme, thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.